Between 1939 and the eve of the German invasion, the Soviets had produced 80,000 mortars and guns, 17,000 aircraft, and 7,500 tanks, including nearly 2,000 late model T-34s and KV-1s. Russia, not Germany, was both a fuel and food exporter. The Soviets could field more army divisions than all of the Axis powers combined. Yet again, Hitler ignored or downplayed those realities. Instead, he relied on massage German intelligence that was ignorant of the advanced state of Russian armaments. The Nazi hierarchy was sorely out of date in its assessments of the modern Red Army. It had focused on Stalin's 1938 and 1939 purges of the Red Army's officer corps, the lethargic Soviet advances into Poland in 1939, and problems subduing Finland in 1940 as confirmation of the Russian Army's chronic poor performance dating back to the Russo-Japanese War of 1904 and 1905 and the collapse of the Tsarist ground forces in 1917. None of that, however, was necessarily a referendum on the wisdom of fighting on Russian soil in mid-1941. Germany had humiliated the Soviets at Brest-Litovsk in 1918. Hitler likewise knew that Soviet-German military cooperation in the 1920s and 1930s was supposedly predicated on the notion that Soviet industry and technology had more to learn than to teach. In 1940, Hitler also apparently had relied on ossified World War I West-East equations. If France had proved unconquerable in World War I and Russia was defeated in less than 3 years, then the fall of France in 1940 in 6 weeks might mean that this time around Russia would crumble in a month, as if a still ascendant Russian communism in 1939 was similar to a tottering Tsarist Russia of 1917, or the confident French of 1914 were the same people as those in 1939 and 1940. In May 1941, Karl Bremer, the director of the German-controlled press during the occupation of France, supposedly got drunk during a reception at the Bulgarian embassy in Berlin. He soon blurted out German plans to invade Russia that reflected the illusions that the abrupt collapse of the once-vaunted French army had encouraged. Inside of 2 months, our dear Nazi ideologue Alfred Rosenberg will be boss of all Russia, and Stalin will be dead. We will demolish the Russians quicker than we did the French. Bremer was just channeling more Hitlerian myth-making. During his victory tour of Paris in June 1940, Hitler scoffed to General Wilhelm Keitel, head of OKH, Oberkommando des Heeres, Supreme Command of the Army, how much easier defeating Russia would be than the just-completed conquest of France. "Believe me, Keitel, a campaign against Russia would be like a child's game in a sandbox by comparison. As for leaving Britain unconquered to the rear, the experience of World War I weighed on Hitler. For all his grand talk of Eastern Lebensraum and strategic minerals, farmland and oil, Hitler's wartime experience was entirely in the West. The brutal battles of the Somme and Passchendaele convinced him that the Western Front would always be the tougher nut to crack. Hitler therefore found consolation in the idea that, just as Imperial Russia had not survived the Kaiser even though Britain had, so too would Stalin fall even if Churchill would not. Russia's leadership worried only about the survival and expansion of Soviet communism and the Stalinist regime. To the degree the British and French conceivably could have made ironclad anti-German assurances to Russia before 1939, Stalin might have cemented negotiations with them on a common front, thereby most likely delaying or even preventing what would become a world war. But Stalin could not forge a partnership given the French and British unwillingness to sell out quite so brazenly the idea of self-determination in Eastern Europe that was already sacrificed to German and Soviet agendas. The Soviets then were quite prepared to cut a better deal with Hitler to divide Poland and to pledge mutual non-aggression. That pact was seen as a continuance of both their own renegade military cooperation and their mutual loathing of the idea of an independent Poland. Russia could now face down Japan. Hitler was freed eventually to eye France. Stalin might well have preferred a pact all along with a fellow totalitarian like Hitler. Only a very able man could accomplish what Hitler had done in solidifying the German people, whatever we thought of the methods, to one with Western Democrats. For his part, Hitler appreciated that those who had mastered the absolute use of power were likely to be more sympathetic to similar aggrandizing dictators. Hitler came to idolize Stalin, even late in the war as the Red Army was destroying the Wehrmacht. Churchill has nothing to show for his life's work except a few books and clever speeches in Parliament. Stalin, on the other hand, has, without doubt, leaving aside the question of what principle he was serving, reorganized a state of 170 million people and prepared it for a massive armed conflict. If Stalin ever fell into my hands, I would probably spare him and perhaps exile him to some spa. Churchill and Roosevelt would be hanged. After the pact, Russia looked to the Baltic states and the borderlands with Eastern Europe and soon displayed an appetite for conquest that even Hitler found inordinate. In Soviet thinking, the communists were only recovering what had properly belonged to Russia under the Tsars, but had been liberated or plundered during the chaotic transition to communism. In addition, the Soviets did not always deliver all the promised resources to the Third Reich, and continually upped their demands for German technology and industrial goods, convincing Hitler that perhaps the non-aggression accord shorted German interests, especially in terms of receiving Russian oil. Stalin grew ever more worried that France, as the traditional bulwark to German expansionism, collapsed much too quickly. He shortly thereafter formally annexed the Baltic states, cut out swathes of Romanian territory, and stepped up rearmament. Germany put up with all this to be free to war against the Western European democracies, which Stalin had assumed would put up a much tougher fight than his own targeted acquisitions. Ironically, democracies did nothing for Czechoslovakia and little more for Poland, rendering void all their prior principled unwillingness to agree to Stalin's realpolitik as the price of alliance. Any long-term partnership between Stalin and Hitler was bound to fail. Communism was not a kindred ideology of Nazism. With general class rather than particular racial enemies, Marxism had proven far more dynamic and with more international appeal than had the Aryan racial obsessions of National Socialism, and was thus seen by Hitler as Nazi Germany's chief existential threat. Both nations still nursed recriminations from the prior war. The Soviets still chafed under the humiliating terms of Russia's capitulation in 1918. The Germans remembered that the atrocious behavior of Tsarist armies in 1914 in East Prussia had rivaled their own savagery in Belgium. If a Soviet pact with the West might have deterred war, one with Hitler ensured it in the long term. Russia likewise was critical to the cause and evolution of the Pacific War. Its victory over the Japanese army in a series of Manchurian border wars between May and September 1939 convinced many in the Japanese military that it was unwise to fight the Soviet Union unilaterally on its eastern boundaries. Marshal Georgi Zhukov's ground forces were better led, better equipped, and more numerous than those of the Japanese army. In addition, Stalin, at the end of the border fighting, had enhanced his military advantages by signing a non-aggression pact with Japan's supposedly anti-communist Axis partner, Nazi Germany. Subsequent Japanese realpolitik and a bitter sense of betrayal by Germany would lead Tokyo to formalize its own non-aggression pact with Stalin in April 1941. The tit-for-tat double-cross would have two fundamental consequences to the nature of the alliances of World War II and explain the expansion of the war into a worldwide conflict. One, Japan in June 1941, without an invitation to join the initial invasion, would not subsequently aid Hitler's Operation Barbarossa with a simultaneous attack from the east along the Manchurian border. The reluctance arose partly out of both Japanese self-interest and pique, but also partly because a greedy and ascendant Hitler had snubbed the Japanese in June 1941. He would not, by late 1942, because he had wished to claim all his envisioned winnings alone. Indeed, when the Germans were apprised of the Japanese decision in April 1941 to form their own pact with Stalin just weeks before Operation Barbarossa, General Varlimont noted the indifference or even the relief at the accord among German officers. "We don't need anyone just to strip the corpses." By September, after 3 months of mostly German success, Hitler bragged, "Today everybody is dreaming of a world peace conference. For my part, I prefer to wage war for another 10 years, rather than be cheated thus of the spoils of victory." Perhaps Hitler also quite wrongly figured that a Japanese attack in the east against a lightly populated Siberia was not of much immediate help against the centers of Russian industry and commerce, at least in comparison to the Japanese tying down Anglo-American naval forces and some ground troops in the Pacific and Asia. Japan's non-intervention nonetheless guaranteed that the beleaguered Soviet Union would avoid a two-front war and would have Vladivostok free to receive unimpeded U.S. lend-lease aid from West Coast ports of America. In response, by December 1941, Stalin had rushed almost 20 divisions westward for the defense of Moscow, which helped to stall Hitler's siege and the successful German Blitzkrieg of 1941. After the war, the incompetent Field Marshal Keitel confessed that even rapid German advancement and historic victories had not translated to a rapid victory, as was true between 1939 and 1941. After the decisive battles at Bryansk, which was a terrific beating for the Russians, or perhaps after the siege of Moscow and Leningrad, or after the battles on the Donets Basin, one had to realize that it would come to a long war. The armistice with the Japanese on September 14, 1939, also had assured the Russians of a safe rear, and so greenlighted their invasion of Poland, in the manner that a more formal Soviet-Japanese non-aggression pact on April 13, 1941, had likewise unleashed Japan upon Britain and the United States. Given the choice of a slugfest with Russia or, after June 1940, the lure of poorly defended Dutch, French, and perhaps British colonies now ripe for the plucking, the Japanese, especially the army, logically preferred resource-rich Asia and the Pacific. Note that for the most part, Stalin honored both his promises with the Nazis and the Imperial Japanese far more assiduously than he would his post-war agreements with Britain and the United States. Perhaps it was worse even than that. Stalin kept to the letter of his non-aggression pact with Japan to ensure that Soviet-bound ships could leave American ports safely and reach Vladivostok through Japanese-controlled waters. The Soviets would eagerly accept U.S. lend-lease and ensure its delivery by abetting America's archenemy. In the hierarchy of autocratic deceit, it was hard to determine which dictatorship was the chief offender. Japan, which had made assorted deals with Hitler's archenemy to avoid a three-front war. Germany, which had earlier made a deal with Japan's archenemy to avoid a two-front war. Or Russia, which had, at various times, made deals with both Germany and Japan that harmed Britain and America, whose supplies would keep it alive. Nazi Germany, Japan, and the Soviet Union for nearly 2 years had all jockeyed with one another to prevent a two-theater conflict, the fear of all six major belligerents of World War II. Yet when the war finally ended in 1945, only an opportunistic Stalin had achieved his aim of largely avoiding such a war. During the destruction of Poland, Winston Churchill had presciently said of the Soviet Union's 1939 double cross, "I cannot forecast to you the action of Russia. It is a riddle wrapped in a mystery inside an enigma. But perhaps there is a key. That key is Russian self-interest." The strengths and weakness of the various major belligerents, the nature of their governments, and their decisions to exploit perceived weakness or to punish unprovoked aggression explain the memberships of the respective wartime alliances by late 1941. Russia was the only belligerent that mostly eschewed naval warfare and systematic strategic bombing to focus on its infantry by fielding the war's largest army. For all Stalin's machinations to gain territories without cost, in the end Russia paid by far the highest price of any of the belligerents. Historians still seek to sort out the degree to which the Soviets' catastrophe was a result of their own duplicity. Note as well that while Stalin, between 1941 and 1944, constantly berated the British and Americans for failing to open an immediate second front against his former partner Hitler, he nonetheless rejected outright any counter-suggestion that the Russians might at least do something on their own Asian borders against Japanese occupiers to relieve their allies from the pressures of a two-front war against the Axis and to facilitate the transport of aid to China. In fact, Stalin enumerated various reasons why he would not engage the Japanese, all of which boiled down to the reluctance to fight the dual-enemy conflict that his own allies were engaged in, even if they were pitted against far fewer Axis soldiers. It might not be entirely fair to Stalin, but it nonetheless remains an accurate generalization that no other single individual was responsible for more deaths between 1925 and 1945, whether by forced famines, mass executions, the aid to and empowerment of Hitler until June 1941, the reckless wastage of the Red Army in 1941 and 1942, and the political cleansing of Eastern Europe between 1945 and 1946. The Soviet Union entered the war seeking to grab territory with Hitler and ended the war acquiring more than it had ever envisioned by warring against him. Great Britain was the only Allied power that fought the entire war against Germany and its Axis partners from September 3, 1939 to Japan's formal surrender on September 2, 1945 in Tokyo Bay. Of what would become the big three Allied nations of Great Britain, the Soviet Union, and the United States, only Britain had begun hostilities against an Axis power without being directly attacked itself when it nominally went to war on behalf of its ally Poland. Great Britain and its empire, not France, the United States, or the Soviet Union, was also the only Allied nation that ever faced Germany alone from the fall of Western Europe in May 1940 to the invasion of Russia in June 1941. With well less than half the material and human resources of the United States, it would nonetheless fight in Europe, Italy, Sicily, and North Africa, on and below the high seas, in the Pacific, and along with the United States would conduct a costly strategic bombing campaign over Europe. Its expanding economy was the most underrated of the three Allied powers. The Dominions, especially Australia, Canada, New Zealand, and South Africa, offered steady supplies and many of the war's best soldiers, who were central to the British strategy for fighting a global war. More than half of all British divisions, as well as 40% of RAF crews, were raised in the Dominions, colonies, and India. Hitler talked grandly of the British Empire, but he had no idea of the resources, industrial, agricultural, financial, military, and human, that Britain might exploit in a world war, or of how loyal such diverse British subjects would prove to be in supplying hundreds of thousands of troops to the British military. Hitler did not fully appreciate the obvious fact that Britain had a far greater navy than any of the three Axis powers in 1939, or that British air forces were rapidly evolving to become better balanced and coordinated than was the Luftwaffe. The need to fight over vast distances and to protect imperial ground made it natural for the British to emphasize air and naval power, and to avoid a meat-grinder ground war in France and Belgium. The Nazi regime seemed to be completely clueless about the vast transformation in British military preparedness that had begun in late 1938. In Hitler's obsessions with land warfare, the fact that Britain had not mobilized a huge expeditionary army in the fashion of 1916 apparently deluded him about the importance of growing British sea and air power and their abilities to ensure supply lines for troops and imports. From the outset of World War II in September 1939, Great Britain alone of the Allies also articulated the nature of the Axis threat, predicted the course of Nazi aggression, and anchored the future alliance, largely because of the singular leadership of Winston Churchill after May 10, 1940, and the inherent resilience of the British people. As early as 1937, Churchill had warned the haughty German ambassador to Britain, Joachim von Ribbentrop, that the British were not as comparatively weak as their prior appeasement might otherwise have indicated. At the German embassy in London, Churchill had refused to be complicit with Germany's designs on Eastern Europe and the USSR, earning threats from Ambassador Ribbentrop. In reply, Churchill offered, "Do not underrate England. She is very clever. If you plunge us all into another great war, she will bring the whole world against you, like last time." The Germans did not grasp that appeasement was not necessarily static, but rather a momentary wish not to suffer moderate casualties in exchange for the hope of avoiding them altogether, a mood that could eventually lead to frustration and with it war with righteous indignation and zeal. Or as George Orwell and others noted, in international politics, you must either be willing to practice appeasement indefinitely or at some point be ready to fight. Nor was appeasement necessarily a barometer of military preparedness. An appeasing nation can often enjoy military superiority over an aggressor, albeit with a far greater desire not to use the superior assets it enjoys. After mid-1944, Britain fought, if briefly, over some of the same battlegrounds anyway. The much longer and greater American role between 1941 and 1945 than in 1917 and 1918 meant that the British lost fewer lives than they had in World War I. By 1945, Russia had borne the bulk of infantry fighting against the German colossus, unlike the Tsar's army that had dissolved well before the Western Armistice on November 11, 1918. The resurgent Red Army in 1942, fighting on a single front, allowed Britain to free up more of its resources to expand air power and to fight a second front against the Japanese, the sort of global outreach that exceeded expeditionary efforts in World War I. Had Winston Churchill made an agreement with Germany in June 1940, as Hitler and some British grandees sometimes fantasized, or had he not become Prime Minister in the prior month, then Nazi Germany either might not have turned on Russia or might conceivably have beaten it. Only the survival of Britain meant the resurrection of a second European front against Hitler in the West, albeit by air power and Mediterranean fighting prior to June 1944. Without a free Britain, there would have been neither an early American bombing campaign nor an eventual American landing in Western Europe. At the least, without Britain, the United States would have lacked a forward staging area from which to retake the continent. The remarkable resistance of Britain in 1940 did much to convince the United States to invest the greater share of its efforts in the European theater of operations. The British expertise accrued from fighting the Germans from September 1939 onward proved invaluable to the United States in 1942. The least powerful and populous of the three major allies, Great Britain proved in many respects the most principled and the most effective, given the resources at its disposal and always with the acceptance that the burdens of the global and often lonely war might leave post-war Britain reduced in power as a post-war world gravitated to the Soviet Union and the United States. Americans may have tired of British lectures and their imperial pretensions, but the British were crucial to the Allied alliance, dependable, courageous, ingenious, and talented in ways no other power could match. Of the six major powers in World War II, America alone did not in any substantial way have its traditional continental homeland invaded or bombed. Two oceans with thousands of miles of seas between the United States, Asia, and Europe protected American industry, as Hitler himself soon lamented. But if such distance ensured uninterrupted American military production, it also meant that America did not have a close affinity with European and Asian politics. For far too long, it lacked an accurate, up-to-date appraisal of the nature of the Axis militaries. As was true in World War I, the confident Americans would arrive in Europe, whether in Sicily, Italy, or at bases in Britain, convinced that they had the answers to defeat Germany in a way the far more experienced British did not. America prior to Pearl Harbor freely offered advice, but despite budding rearmament, was also shockingly ill-prepared for an extended land or air war. While the British and the Europeans had all but disarmed by the early 1930s, they had rather rapidly wised up after Munich. By 1939, both France and Britain had neared Germany's annual defense outlays, investing between 21 and 23% of their respective gross national product in rearming. By 1940, the combined defense spending of the two economies exceeded Germany's. In contrast, despite a massive naval expansion program, America still spent only 1% of GNP on defense in 1939 and a mere 2% in 1940, even as the war was raging in Europe. As a percentage of America's budgetary dollars, defense expenditure dipped between 1932 and 1939, and often the money spent was not efficiently allotted but reflected congressional pork-barrel interests. America's secure geography was also a double-edged sword. Whereas the fronts were safely distant from the United States, they also were hard and costly to reach, and sometimes dangerous to supply. Throughout the war, the United States had the largest supply and transportation overhead of the conflict. It dispatched soldiers and material across the globe, often under dangerous skies and in perilous waters. Because the American public was the only wartime populace not under attack, it was more difficult to rally the country on the premise that military defeat would equate with the extinction of America as a nation. Yet the United States was the only belligerent on either side of the conflict to have fought fully in every conceivable theater and manner against Japan, Italy, and Germany. Those extraordinary commitments were reflected in the transformation of the American economy. By the end of 1944, it was allotting over $80 billion per year, well over 40% of its GNP, to the war effort. And by 1945, 93.5% of annual budget outlays went to the military forces or defense-related investments. It spent 20% more of its much larger budget on military forces than did Nazi Germany. For all the Axis talk of decadent Americans, the working men and women of the United States produced far more per capita industrial output than any nation of the war. Mobility was critical to overcoming innate disadvantages of sending troops thousands of miles from home to initiate offensives against far more experienced Axis troops. In response, America invested considerable capital and manpower in its naval and air forces and focused on producing inexhaustible numbers of reliable, easy-to-use, and mostly effective weapons. A 12-million-man military had vast obligations, from supplying the Soviet Union to securing Australia to eroding Axis and Japanese industry by air and sea. The two most expensive weapons programs of the war, the Manhattan Project and the B-29 bomber, were both designed to bring destruction to faraway enemies by air. By the early 20th century, the U.S. military had never envisioned starting a major war by rolling across its borders into Mexico or Canada, and so it was natural that its pre-war armed forces little resembled the vast German and Soviet armies and armored vehicles. America's early role in World War II was marked by a sharp learning curve between Pearl Harbor and 1943. Initial confusion over proper strategic goals and naivete about the mediocre quality of many first-generation weapons, green troops, and unimpressive field generals were the natural wages of a Depression-era, poorly armed, and isolationist nation gearing up for a world war. Yet by mid-1943, the United States had addressed most of its early liabilities. Its well-led tactical air forces, strategic bombers, carriers, submarines, and ground forces fought in superb fashion, often against enemies that enjoyed geographical and logistical advantages. For two reasons, the United States entered yet another foreign and distant war after being sorely disappointed that the victory of World War I had not achieved the promised lasting peace. First, the Japanese attacked American bases in the Pacific. As noted, had Japan just sidestepped the Philippines and avoided Hawaii in its quest to absorb vulnerable Dutch and French colonial holdings, or concentrated on British-controlled Singapore, Malaysia, Burma, and India, there is little reason to suppose that America would have promptly entered the Pacific War to aid Britain any more than it had intervened during the Blitz, when London's iconic buildings and thousands of its citizens went up in flames. The United States may have romanticized China, but it had done nothing much militarily to help in its decade-long struggle with the Japanese. Second, on December 11, 1941, Germany and Italy declared war on the United States in one of the greatest blunders of World War II. If Germany had not done this, there is no reason to assume that the United States would not have concentrated all its resources on Japan after Pearl Harbor. Hitler's disastrous decision may have been in part emotional. He had a pathological hatred for Franklin Roosevelt, as he had indicated in a number of marathon speeches, most notably an April 1939 diatribe before the Reichstag. Hitler's decision was in part also an ad hoc response to the lobbying from the German Navy, whose submariners wanted to target U.S. convoys at their source, and a general frustration that the supposedly mongrel and profit-minded Americans were supplying enemies of the Third Reich with lend-lease. After declaring war on the United States in December 1941, Hitler hoped that the Japanese Navy would then tie down the Americans and siphon off their expeditionary strength. Neither the marshals of the Wehrmacht nor Hitler had any real intuition of the disasters that would rapidly befall Germany as a result of this impulsive decision. General Vorlamont claimed he was baffled by Hitler's sudden declaration and struggled to cite three possible reasons for the inexplicable act. 1. Fidelity to his part of the treaty with Japan. 2. His romantic feeling of wanting to support a soldierly nation such as Japan. And 3. The continued hostile attitude of the United States. After the war, these sentiments were reiterated when a soon-to-be-hanged Joachim von Ribbentrop gave self-interested and confused answers to his interrogators when asked why Hitler had started a war with the United States. He claimed that although he was always against the idea, Hitler asserted that American aid to the British already constituted a state of war, and that the Third Reich owed Japan support if their alliance were to mean anything, an odd inference, if true, given that the Germans had no hesitation about double-crossing Japan in August 1939 by signing a non-aggression pact with the Soviets while Stalin was engaged in a de facto border war with the Japanese Imperial Army. In addition, by early December 1941, the Wehrmacht was already stalled outside Moscow. Hitler wrongly assumed, along with the Japanese, that an ill-prepared America might be an easy alternate target, a Napoleonic habit of starting new wars before old ones were finished that had also prompted him earlier to turn attention to Russia when his blitz over Britain had failed. Americans this time around were convinced after Pearl Harbor by the Roosevelt administration, despite their great distance from the fronts in Europe and Asia, that they were not fighting an optional war but a defensive one for their very survival, and that reality prompted mobilization and preparation that exceeded even the gargantuan efforts of 1917 and 1918. Quite unlike in World War I, the Americans now faced the dilemma of a two-front war and a paradox in the priorities of fighting it. The greater existential threat was Nazi Germany, but the more immediate and emotional concern was Imperial Japan. Unlike the Third Reich, the Japanese had attacked U.S. territory and slaughtered American sailors and soldiers at a time of peace. Because both the Soviet Union and Britain had adopted a Germany-first policy, the United States wondered why it should as well when there was an Allied void in the Pacific. America would answer that question by proclaiming a Europe-first policy, but, in actuality, by generously outsourcing much of the Pacific War to the U.S. Navy, Marines, and some crack Army divisions. The United States fielded the second-largest military of the war, reaching over 12 million in uniform. All told, over 16 million would cumulatively serve. It suffered proportionally the fewest combat casualties of the major powers, about 416,000, or a little over 3% of those enrolled in the military. That human economy was possible because America built the greatest number of aircraft, launched the largest tonnage of ships, fielded the largest and most efficient medical services, and finally, by mid-1945, produced a greater national product than all the other five warring nations combined. The United States did not enter the war to grab new territory in the manner of Germany, Italy, Japan, and the Soviet Union. America ended up eventually returning most of what it had conquered. The initial American strategy was to strike as quickly as possible at the heartland of the Third Reich, defeat the Wehrmacht, remove the Nazis, and then invade Japan. Americans had met and defeated a tiring German army in 1917 and 1918, and had not experienced something like Verdun or the Somme. Their leaders knew the fickle and impatient nature of the American public, eager for rapid, decisive victories and equally quick to tire and turn on long, drawn-out engagements that did not bring rapid and unambiguous results. Just a month after Pearl Harbor, the Roosevelt administration sought seemingly impossible yearly production goals of 20,000 anti-aircraft guns, 45,000 tanks and armored vehicles, and 60,000 aircraft. By the war's end, it had sometimes achieved those targets. In sum, the idea of the Allies shifted throughout the war. Before June 1940, the plural noun Allies denoted Great Britain and the Western democracies of Europe. After the collapse of France, Scandinavia, and the Low Countries in 1940, and the invasion of Russia in June 1941, the Soviet Union and Great Britain, now loosely aligned with China, were the only Allied powers left actively fighting the Axis powers. By December 1941, some 27 months after the start of the war, the Allied alliance was again recalibrated by the Pearl Harbor attack and the Axis powers' respective declarations of war on the United States. What bound together the new so-called Big Three of America, Britain, and Russia was certainly not ideological brotherhood, much less liberal values and consensual government, or a willingness of each to fight all three Axis powers. Instead, the common bond of the big three, although a strong one, was the shared experience of having Nazi Germany either invade a member's homeland, preemptively declare war on a member, or attack a member's ally, as well as a shared existential desire to destroy Nazi Germany. For their part, the Axis powers, despite pre-war professions of solidarity, genuine fascist commonalities, and empty talk of pacts of steel and the like, changed their own coalition just as radically. Unlike the Allied alliance, the Axis League was predicated not in reaction to what the enemy had done, but entirely on ephemeral perceptions of Germany winning the war and ensuring a favorable post-war settlement. Germany was the lone Axis power at war between September 1939 and June 1940. As France was overrun in June 1940, Mussolini's Italy belatedly joined Germany in the expectation of easy spoils from already beaten or weakened enemies. After December 7, 1941, the notion of the Axis expanded yet again to include Japan and a few Eastern European nations when the Japanese Imperial Navy attacked the United States and Great Britain in the Pacific in anticipation that a reeling Britain and Russia would soon be defeated, leaving a neutral, supposedly disarmed and isolated United States to make concessions. Tragic irony was always a trademark of World War II. The Allies had little ideological affinity and yet fought as partners in pursuit of righteous revenge. The Axis were kindred fascists, but waged aggressive war often at cross purposes and as individual belligerents in dreams of their own particular aggrandizement. How the war was fought across the globe proved just as paradoxical as how it started, and as ironic as how and why the belligerents had formed their respective alliances. Many of the decisions involving strategy, weaponry, industrial policy, manpower, technology, and leadership were derived from the same mindset and assumptions that had led the Axis powers to go to war in the first place, and the Allies to seek a terrible response. Part 2. Air. The Follies and Brilliance of Air Power. And in the air are no streets, no channels, no point where one can say of an antagonist, if he wants to reach my capital, he must come by here. In the air, all directions lead everywhere. H. G. Wells. 4. The Air Power Revolution. The Axis and the Allies produced 800,000 military, transport, and trainer planes during World War II, an astonishing development given that air power had only come of age during World War I. Almost 300,000 planes were lost to combat or accidents, or were too badly damaged to be salvaged. The Allies built three times as many aircraft as the Axis. In the critical categories of heavy bombers, transports, and fighter bombers, the aircraft of the Allies very quickly proved as superior in quality as they were greater in quantity, and they gave the victors advantages in mobility, deployment, and offensive reach undreamed of by the Axis. Record-keeping was predictably sporadic, especially on the Eastern Front. Many of the documents of the German Luftwaffe, for example, were lost by war's end, both by intent and in the flotsam and jetsam of the chaos of spring 1945. Nonetheless, a good guess is that about 350,000 pilots and air crewmen on all sides died, although air fatalities in most militaries were lumped in with army losses. Perhaps nearly 2 million European and Asian civilians perished from strategic bombing raids, at least half of them women and children. World War II began with the bombing of Warsaw and ended with the atomic bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Despite the impressive advances in air power, perhaps only 3% of military casualties during World War II were related to the use of aircraft. Still, air power proved the greatest single expenditure of all military investments, comprising on average 30% of the major belligerents' outlay and over 40% of America's wartime budget. The costly venture, one especially favored by the democracies as a way of reducing infantry losses, was predicated not on killing lots of the enemy per se, but on destroying its machines and its ability to produce war material. Air power required building and maintaining complex machines, airfields, and communications, the unprecedented consumption of expensive aviation fuels, and the costs of aircraft maintenance, as well as an extraordinary outlay in training pilots and crews in a way not true of ground troops. The cost-effectiveness of air power was always hard to calibrate. By 1941, air forces were so deeply embedded within tactical Army and Navy operations, logistics, and transportation that it was almost impossible to isolate them as either a separate budgetary cost or a single strategic dividend. There was also the psychological component, how to calibrate the terror instilled by shrieking Stukas in Poland and France, or what the incineration of Tokyo and destruction at Hiroshima and Nagasaki did to the Japanese commitment never to surrender. It is canonical that air power in and of itself cannot end a war, but the Japanese gave up without being invaded, arguably in large part due to the B-29 fire raids and the dropping of two atomic bombs, rather than just the Soviet invasion of Manchuria. Armored operations were not critical to the Japanese Army. Amphibious assaults were not routine German naval operations. The Soviets did not conduct much strategic bombing. However, every belligerent employed some sort of tactical air force and diverted key resources from both the Army and Navy to fund it. Likewise, military aircraft spawned ancillary weapons and technologies completely unseen in the past, from huge aircraft carriers and airborne troops to guided missiles, smart rocket bombs, and jet fighters. The two deadliest breakthroughs of the war, napalm and atomic bombs, were weapons of the air. Over Tokyo on March 9th and 10th, 1945, and Hiroshima on August 6th, 1945, they accounted for the two most lethal days in the history of warfare. Until the 20th century, fighters were either soldiers or sailors. The hoplites of Marathon, the sailors on triremes at Salamis, the men both on and beneath the walls of Vienna, the sailors at Lepanto, the cavalry at Waterloo, and those manning ships of the line at Trafalgar. All missiles, arrows, sling balls, javelins, and artillery projectiles were launched from the ground or ships. During most of the age of gunpowder until the late 19th century, the attacker was usually within sight of the intended target. In 1939, all that changed forever. Of course, fighting in the air was not entirely novel in 1939. A rare use of hot air balloons in the Napoleonic Wars, 1799 or 1803 through 1815, and the later famous 1849 Austrian bombing of Venice caused consternation but had no effect on the course of those wars. Thousands of biplanes in World War I put combatants above the earth in a way only dreamed about since the Myth of Icarus or the sketchbooks of Leonardo da Vinci. Aerial fighting after 1914 escalated rapidly, often involving thousands of planes. Yet even then, airplanes were still considered unreliable or even dangerous machines and thus had little influence on the strategic pulse of the conflict. Despite the production by late 1918 on all sides of an aggregate 200,000 war and transport planes. Nonetheless, in World War I, the French and British only sporadically bombed Germany. Berlin remained almost completely untouched. German zeppelins and bombers inflicted slight damage and loss of life in Britain and France during World War I, far less than a single typical Allied bombing raid 20-some years later. Air power by 1918 finally had grown to be important tactically over France and Belgium, but had yet to evolve into an effective strategic weapon. But by the outbreak of World War II, just four decades of aviation had already led to monoplanes so powerful and fast that those directing the air war suddenly began making astounding promises of air supremacy over the battlefield. These theories were grounded on a central premise. Soldiers would not just transfer their fighting to the skies, but by doing so would reinvent battles below. As is commonly the case during cycles of radical technological breakthroughs, interwar euphoria over air power soon led to fantastic claims that air power would eliminate most fighting on the ground altogether. The pre-war Italian air theorist General Giulio Duet, in dramatic fashion, warned that To have command of the air means to be in a position to wield offensive power so great it defies human imagination. It means to be able to cut an enemy's army and navy off from their bases of operation and nullify their chances of winning the war. It means complete protection of one's own country, the efficient operation of one's army and navy, and peace of mind to live and work in safety. In short, it means to be in a position to win. To be defeated in the air, on the other hand, is finally to be defeated and to be at the mercy of the enemy, with no chance at all of defending oneself, compelled to accept whatever terms he sees fit to dictate. The failed German blitz over Britain would early on prove De Witt absolutely wrong in almost every claim. The problem with such air and armor prophets was not that they were mistaken per se, but that their exaggerated and melodramatic forecasts made no allowances for the age-old challenge and response cycles. For every unstoppable tank or bomber that always got through, World War II proved that there would emerge a new counterweapon, such as a cheap handheld Panzerfaust anti-tank weapon or high-performance fighter. Grandiose theories about omnipotent air power were understandable, given the lingering trauma arising from the Western European trenches and subsequent vows never to fight such a static infantry battle again. The utopian efforts of well-meaning statesmen in the 1920s to outlaw certain planes and bombing strategies, conversely, also meant exaggerating public fears of air power, while also stoking their own military's desires to possess air forces as lethal as possible. The technological breakthroughs of the interwar period in aviation science, the payload, range, and speed of fighters and bombers tripled between 1935 and 1940 alone, also frightened European publics. The rapid growth of air power in the 1920s and 1930s was analogous to the specter of nuclear weapons in the early Cold War, which was another argument that new weapons had grown so terrible that wars of any sort could never be fought again without the utter destruction of civilizations. A new generation of fast and high-flying planes, it was believed, would bypass the battlefield to attack the civilian rear. Warplanes alone would end an enemy's economic ability to make war, or at least would terrorize a population into calling off its military effort altogether, thereby diminishing the loss of life. In other words, no theorist or politician quite knew what to expect of air power in the next war. I think it is well also for the man in the street to realize that there is no power on earth that can protect him from being bombed. Whatever people may tell him, the bomber will always get through. The only defense is in offense, which means that you have to kill more women and children more quickly than the enemy if you want to save yourselves. So, on November 10, 1932, British Prime Minister Stanley Baldwin infamously offered his pessimistic assessment of air defenses to the British House of Commons. True, Baldwin might have been correct that a majority of bombers on most missions might usually get through, but they would do so only at such a high cost, and often with such questionable results, that doubt would arise over the sustainability and efficacy altogether of strategic bombing. Later, Baldwin would accept that fighter and bomber production could provide Britain deterrence against the German threat of invasion. But his successor, Neville Chamberlain, eventually returned to the earlier view that massive rearmament was wasteful and provocative, even though to his credit he maintained fighter production and encouraged Air Force development. The problem with Baldwin and Chamberlain was not that they had unilaterally disarmed Britain, but that both did not accelerate and expand British fighter production at a rate that was attainable, given British industrial and technological advancement, and what was warranted by the rise of the Third Reich. The major pre-war prophets of the air, Clama Adair, military aviation, Julio Douay, command of the air, Colonel William Billy Mitchell, wing defense, Royal Air Force Marshal Hugh Trenchard, and General Walter Vever, had in varying degrees predicted not just that air power would be integral to all land and sea tactical operations of the future, but also that strategic bombing could radically diminish enemy production. Among them, Vefer perhaps was the least dogmatic. He tried to ensure a multifaceted tactical and strategic capability for the Luftwaffe, rather than having it become an independent branch of the military that possessed the ability to win wars for Germany entirely through air operations against the industrial and population centers of the enemy. Again, some of the air determinists later were to be proven partly right by the cinders of Berlin and Tokyo, and perhaps by the dropping of the atomic bombs, but quite wrong by the horrendous losses of the Luftwaffe, RAF Bomber Command, and the U.S. Army Air Forces, as well as the need of the Allies to invade the homelands of Germany and Italy to end the war. Even after prolonged bombing campaigns, cities and their inhabitants were surprisingly resilient. Planes, it turned out, were like catapults and crossbows. Their effectiveness hinged on technological challenge and response and evolving proper tactics and strategies. Soon, flak guns, barrage balloons, radar, and fighter aircraft checked the raw offensive power of the bomber, along with nature in the form of fog, ice, clouds, and high winds that were often the best defenses of Berlin and Tokyo. By late 1940, the pre-war dreams of new, uncontested weapons of the skies had been brought back to Earth. Air power, it turned out, could not level the industries of island fortress Britain any more than nightly appearances of German Heinkel, Dornier, and Junkers bombers could terrorize the London public into giving up. Thousand-plane British area bombing raids might have engulfed Hamburg in flames, but nonetheless did not initially much curb the German production of new Tiger and Panther tanks that would blast apart their Russian counterparts. Humans, after all, live not in the air but on the ground, and sometimes underground during bombing attacks. As deadly as strategic bombing might eventually become in World War II, it might never replace the Neanderthal need to meet the enemy on the ground, destroy his will to resist, defeat him, and occupy his territory. Air power could not see soldiers hiding in reinforced buildings or interrogate prisoners or talk with civilians. Critics of air power argued over whether bombers and fighters were simply assets transferred to another theater of operations, and one less relevant than ground warfare in forcing an enemy to surrender. Yet, by 1943, once air power was freed from its fantastical pre-war promises, and with the continual appearance of far better engines, airframes, guidance, and sighting systems, strategic bombing and tactical air support slowly had begun to substantiate some of the wild claims of its pre-war messiahs. Improved fighters became instant force multipliers of armor and infantry in a way not seen before 1939. Multitudes of long-range escort fighters, rather than new, advanced bomber designs per se, finally empowered the deep penetrations of air squadrons. With air supremacy, destroying the enemy's air forces to gain a monopoly of the skies, and thus to attack with near impunity everything below, anything was possible. Without it, the airplane was simply nullified by another airplane. As air advocate Alexander P. Dsevirsky put it, only air power can defeat air power. The actual elimination or even stalemating of an attacking air force can be achieved only by a superior air force. Again, the great controversy of air power in World War II was not that planes created great damage on the ground. By 1945, many parts of the great industrial and capital cities of the defeated Axis, Berlin, Bremen, Dusseldorf, Hamburg, Kobe, Mainz, Milan, Tokyo, and Yokohama, lay in rubble, and the culprit was most often air power. Instead, the question hinged on the degree to which warplanes brought enough military dividends to justify their high costs, and if so, exactly how they were to be employed. By 1945, the rough consensus was that when air supremacy, effective enemy air opposition, no longer exists, or perhaps even superiority, enemy air opposition is consistently defeated, was finally achieved, then a new force might be unleashed in spectacular fashion to destroy armies, navies, industries, and civilian centers in ways otherwise impossible. It was assumed that naval and ground anti-aircraft systems could not nullify the offensive punch of aircraft. Yet should belligerents find themselves almost evenly matched, stalemate in the skies became a diversion of resources, perhaps otherwise better spent on the ground, especially given that the losses of pilots and crews often exceeded the fatality rates of foot soldiers. Pilots were as important as planes, and sometimes good pilots in mediocre planes could match bad pilots in superior aircraft. Airmen were also not just combatants, but technicians of sorts, who had to become more attuned to the workings of their machines than those who drove internal combustion engines below. Most important, airmen could target the enemy almost anywhere they pleased. The battle space was now to be gauged in cubic, not square, yards. It seemed as if the practical elements of all the classical military handbooks from Aeneas Tacitus, Vegetius, Sun Tzu, and the Byzantine Emperor Maurice, to generals Karl von Clausewitz and Antoine-Henri Jomini, were suddenly to be rendered irrelevant. Air zealots were convinced that they were creators of an entirely new military science and doctrine. Ships before the 20th century had fought only at sea level. Seasoned Alpine troops who fought in Scandinavia between 1939 and 1940, or Anglo-American and Japanese troops who climbed through the high ground of the China-Burma theater, rarely fought much above 10,000 feet. In contrast, airplanes now battled from near ground level to 30,000 feet in a three-dimensional fashion unknown among earth and sea-bound soldiers and sailors, and in an atmosphere unobstructed by coastlines or mountains. The Allies sought to send out bombing squadrons, especially with the advent of the B-29 Superfortress in late 1944, that flew so high at 5.5 miles above the earth that they were almost immune from both artillery fire and most enemy fighters. But that assumption sometimes failed to reckon that the increased power and fuel required to reach such altitudes radically impaired bombing accuracy, payload capacity, speed, and both human and mechanical performance. If air power was freed from the impediments of terrain, it was also far more constrained by a nascent and not altogether understood technology. When a Tiger tank stalled or a British destroyer lost power, trapped crews still had some recourse to fight on land or the surface of the sea. In the air, the failure of machines sent crews spiraling to earth in parachutes at best, or free-falling to their deaths at worst. In other words, airplanes, like submarines, were intrinsically more dangerous modes of transport than either surface ships or wheeled vehicles, especially in the terrible weather of the northern latitudes. War at sea was treacherous, but that danger was why most of history's greatest sea battles, Salamis, Lepanto, and Navarino, for example, took place near land. Aeronautics evolved far more rapidly than even the most radical improvements in naval and land warfare. If it had taken 300 years for clumsy matchlocks and harquebuses to displace crossbows and longbows, in just the 20 years between the world wars, air power was completely reinvented. True, the new American Essex-class aircraft carriers that by early 1944 had ensured naval supremacy over the Japanese were far more sophisticated than the smaller and simpler USS Wasp, CV-7, 1940 through 1942, or even the huge battlecruiser converts like the USS Lexington, CV-2, 1927 to 1942, and USS Saratoga, CV-3, 1925 to 1946. Tiger tanks were far more powerful, if hardly more reliable, than their tiny and mostly underarmed German Mark I and II predecessors that crushed Poland. All these improvements, nonetheless, were incremental evolutions rather than path-breaking innovations. Turrets, tracks, armor, and internal combustion engines marked the parameters of tank technology. In contrast, World War II began with plodding biplanes like the British Fairey Swordfish torpedo bomber and ended inconceivably with the deployment of ME-262 German jet fighters and V-2 ballistic missiles. Air power saw the greatest technological breakthroughs of any theater of the war. The allure and potential of such a radically new technology initially seemed to have drawn the top engineering and scientific minds in Europe in a way not true of artillery, tanks, or surface vessels. America's air lords, Hap Arnold, Jimmy Doolittle, Curtis LeMay, and Carl Spatz, proved among the most capable generals of any military in the war. The experience of air battle was also far more solitary. Even in the largest of planes, the behemoth B-29 that burned down much of the urban core of Imperial Japan, for example, only 11 crewmen fought within a single airframe. That was a far different experience from, say, even that of a small Fletcher-class destroyer, which usually required over 300 officers and men, or the tank crews that were accompanied by hundreds of infantrymen and grenadiers at their side. The fighter pilot depended on his own machine far more than other warriors below, and usually had far more ability at his own fingertips to kill and destroy than foot soldiers and sailors. And yet the pilot's own aircraft required a squad of mechanics to fuel, fix, and arm the plane, numbers vastly greater than those to the rear that supplied and equipped a single foot soldier. Esprit de Corps was pyramidal, not lateral, as a host of unseen support soldiers was needed to empower a single pilot or bombing crew. Admiral William Bull Halsey, Jr., 62 when the war ended, was on the bridge of his warships during the Battle of Leyte Gulf, and 63-year-old General Gerd von Rundstedt motored about the front during the 1939 invasion of Poland. In contrast, Supreme Air Marshals rarely flew routine fighter missions, and only occasionally were observers on bombing missions. No one expected General Henry Harley Hap Arnold, commanding general of the U.S. Army Air Forces, to lead B-17 squadrons over Germany, or General Curtis LeMay, veteran of some of the most dangerous B-17 missions and a few B-29 flights from China, to lead the B-29s on the fire raids, as much as either might have liked to. Air power was different. A middle-aged or old man could lead from the bridge or jeep, but not from behind the controls of a fighter or high-performance bomber. Either the greater odds of death in air combat or the rigors of air pressure and altitude made leading from behind far more common among air marshals. Of course, too, a general in a cockpit was more isolated from his men in other bombers than was an army commander in a jeep on the ground. The old World War I ace, Rotund Hermann Göring, like Air Marshal Albert Kesselring, starting out from Cap Grinet across the Channel, had no first-hand and updated knowledge of British Spitfires or of much else above the ground. Remote and distant supreme command, in the manner of Admiral Dönitz's unfamiliarity with the constantly changing threats facing his U-boats, may explain in part why airplanes, like submarines, for much of the war were often so unwisely deployed. Often air campaigns were waged against the recommendations of pilots themselves, whether in the German decisions to turn back from attacking British airfields in 1940 to the area bombing of cities, or in the largely disastrous American daylight precision bombing campaigns of 1942 and 1943. Over 20 American generals and admirals died due to enemy action during combat operations during World War II. The few Army Air Force generals who perished were lost in crashes. For example, Lieutenant General Frank Maxwell Andrews, Lieutenant General Millard Fillmore Harmon, Jr., and Brigadier General James R. Anderson, rather than shot down leading missions. By 1945, aircraft carriers, not battleships, were recognized as the Navy's most lethal attack arm. The two largest American offensive operations in the European theater, Normandy and the Arnhem Campaign, all saw airborne troops play major, if not always successful, roles. Without British Mosquitoes and Typhoons and American Thunderbolt fighter bombers, the Allied ground offensive of July and early August 1944 might well have stalled in Normandy. Between D-Day and the end of the European War on May 8, 1945, American fighters and fighter bombers flew an incredible 212,731 sorties against German forces and expended 24 million rounds of 50-caliber ammunition at the German army, over 70,000 rounds every day and about 20 bullets per enemy combat soldier. German panzers, at any rate, considered it dangerous to be transferred from the Eastern Front to the Western, largely because American and British armor had far more lethal fighter air support than did superb Soviet armor. Ships operated amid squalls and storms. Vast amphibious operations like the D-Day invasion of Normandy went ahead in the middle of rough seas. British cruisers, battleships, destroyers, and carriers in May 1941 closed in on the Bismarck despite fog and high seas. Army Group Center continued its desperate march on Moscow even when late autumn temperatures dipped to almost minus 50 degrees Fahrenheit. Routine cloud cover and the jet stream, however, doomed the early campaigns of high-altitude precision bombing by B-29 superfortresses. Without the confident expectation of serial snowstorms, fog, and overcast skies over Belgium, Hitler would never have ordered his December 16, 1944, Watch on the Rhine campaign through the Ardennes that hinged for a moment successfully on inclement weather that grounded British and American fighter bombers. Even with crude radar sets, weather patterns governed the effectiveness of World War II air power in a way not true of either naval or infantry operations. If weather at the target area was not suitable to bombing, wrote American Brigadier General Haywood S. Hansel, then a whole mission had been wasted and perhaps the lives of many crewmen had been lost to no effect. The epic poet Homer's bowman Paris was deemed less heroic than the spearman Achilles. A medieval knight's death by a crossbow bolt was somehow felt to be tragic in a way that being hacked in face-to-face combat by an aristocrat's broadsword was not. Transferred to the 20th century, that same dichotomy played out with a rookie pilot in a strafing typhoon or thunderbolt above Normandy, easily wiping out a crack German veteran Waffen SS platoon that had survived 3 years of nightmarish battle on the Eastern Front. The lamentations of German generals over the hordes of fighter bombers that shredded their panzers were predicated not just on anger at the Luftwaffe's comparative impotence, but also on the ancestral notion that missile troops, in this case American and British kids in their teens and early 20s piloting Jaeger bombers, Hunter bombers, should not so easily from afar and anonymously kill their supposed veteran infantry betters on the battlefield. World War II infantrymen and sailors objected that air crews' food, accommodations, and hours were far preferable to the alternatives of the trench and foxhole, or the mess hall and hammock on rolling seas. Most airfields were to the rear of the front lines. Relative calm between missions allowed a break from the stress of combat that sailors on a cruiser never had, because they could never quite be sure whether there were enemies below, above, or on the surface. Soldiers complained that they waited weeks for rest and relaxation, but flyboys enjoyed both every day. Such perceptions had nothing to do with the reality of death. B-17 crews, for example, suffered higher casualty percentages than did most infantry units or seamen below. By late 1944 and early 1945, the Luftwaffe on average was losing to accidents and enemy action more than 30% of its deployable fighter force per month. 3 to 4 times as many ground soldiers were wounded as killed, but in the air the ratio was reversed. 3 times as many were killed as injured, no doubt because of the ubiquity of larger caliber machine guns, cannon, and flak, the added enemy of the altitude, and the lack of accessible medical attention. Thin skins of a metal plane offered almost no protection for pilots and crews. Hundreds of machine gun and cannon rounds, usually in calibers larger than those of infantry rifles, often left little flesh remaining. Other than occasional armor behind the seat, most planes did not have the horsepower to accommodate reinforcement of their aluminum airframes. Planes were far faster than land vehicles, and their crashes, therefore, far more lethal. Flying in a bomber was the equivalent of manning a tank or ship without armor. Harold Bird Wilson, Air Vice Marshal and veteran of the Battle of Britain, relates the gruesome story of his squadron commander who mistakenly attacked a heavy German Messerschmitt Bf 110 fighter. Jerry got the better of him, and all we found of him was his shirt. No poem of World War II has been more haunting than Randall Jarrell's The Death of the Ball Turret Gunner, with its eerie last line, "When I died, they washed me out of the turret with a hose." Successfully bailing out of a B-17 or B-29 was no guarantee of survival. Along with the rigors of capture and detention, there were occasional summary executions by civilians, showered daily by incendiaries. My father, a central fire control gunner of more than 36 B-29 missions, once remarked that he sometimes did not even wear a parachute on a low-level fire raid, given that either the inferno or irate civilians below meant instant death if he ever descended from the plane. Fighter bombers often unloaded their magazines on civilian trains, ordinary car traffic, and houses and farms, a fact not forgotten by those on the receiving end when pilots bailed out or ditched. Air crews did not overly worry about the effect of their operations on civilians thousands of feet below. As one B-29 tail gunner remarked years later of the fire raids, "Unlike men on the ground, we were far removed from the suffering we caused far below. We engaged in anonymous destruction." No one lamented, for example, that a British fighter strafed the car of Field Marshal Fedor von Bock, who claimed privately that he had no sympathy for the Nazism that he so eagerly served, killing the general, his wife, and stepdaughter, who were all fleeing the front in the closing days of the war. Historically, cavalry had played 5 chief roles on the Western battlefield. They served as pre-battle reconnaissance forces to scout enemy formations. They covered the exposed flanks of vulnerable infantrymen. As heavier mounted lancers, cavalry blasted a hole for infantry to exploit. Horsemen were also used as rapid pursuers against the vulnerable and fleeing defeated. Occasionally, en masse, they conducted full-scale attacks on enemy infrastructure. The new air cavalry of World War II followed all five of those agendas. During the breakout from Normandy in late July 1944, Allied reconnaissance apprised the American Army of the position of dug-in German formations. In Operation Cobra, launched 7 weeks after the D-Day landings, some 3,000 American heavy and fighter bombers during the last week of July 1944 blasted a hole through German panzer divisions. That massive aerial assault allowed the U.S. First Army to break out from its stagnation within the hedgerows. Once the newly formed American Third Army joined the race eastward from Normandy, General George S. Patton relied on the tactical air cavalry of General Elwood Pete Quesada's fighter bombers to protect the flanks of his fast-moving force from encirclement by superior German panzers. Operation Barbarossa 3 years earlier had been predicated on panzer thrusts that ranged far ahead of infantry, their vulnerable flanks also being protected by the Luftwaffe. Even if American fighter bombers could not always easily stop panzers, they systematically destroyed supply trucks, interrupted logistics, terrified armor and artillery crews, and slaughtered infantry. Weeks later, at the so-called Falaise Pocket, it was the pursuing air formations, in the manner of Napoleonic chasseurs, that inflicted much of the damage on fleeing remnants of Army Group B that had sought to escape from the closing Allied pincers. By war's end, packs of fighters were free-ranging over the enemy's homeland, destroying anything that moved. Air power was revolutionary and traditional all at once. It brought cavalry